Tonight, I'm very happy to welcome back to our store David Rico. David really likes our store, and I'm very grateful for that. And so every time he publishes a new book, he comes up to Many Rivers, and since he's very prolific, that means we get to see him several times a year. His talks are always insightful and humorous, and there's also a lyrical element to them, which I really like. And his latest book is When the Past is Present, Healing the Emotional Wounds that Sabotage Our Relationships, and he'll be talking about this book tonight. Thank you for coming to Many Rivers.
Thank you, Jim. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming. My book is about how, no matter what, we always bring some of our past into our present relationships. And this is, of course, a very common realization. Freud certainly talked a lot about it. I try to show how this is perfectly natural and normal, and that it even has a positive use, because the unfinished business of the past, and I'll talk about what I mean by unfinished business, hangs on in us and waits for the chance for someone to come along who will stir the embers so that it can flame up and we can finally deal with the bonfire of our childhood. And this also applies to past relationships. You would be likely to carry over some of the feelings, expectations, wishes, desires from the past marriage or relationship into the new one, because you're still trying to work something out, and it seems as if someone has come along who either can make everything okay and finally fulfill you, or from a deeper point of view can show you where your work is. That's what usually winds up happening. So that's why I start the book with this beautiful quotation by William Faulkner: "The past is never ended. It isn't even past." And when I say the unfinished business, first of all, of childhood, what I mean is that we come into the world with certain needs, and we instinctively know that our parents are meant to fulfill them. And our parents are instinctively geared to fulfill them, unless they have so many conflicts and issues of their own, or even alcoholism, whatever gets in the way, they wind up not fulfilling our needs so fully or reasonably. And so we emerge from childhood with the feeling of something as missing or damaged or deficient. And then, since the same needs that we had in childhood, which are the needs for attention, affection, appreciation, acceptance, and allowing you to be yourself, what I call the five A's, since these needs are the very same ones that you look for in an intimate relationship, it seems as if I couldn't get it fulfilled in childhood, I will get it fulfilled from this person, which is a lot to expect from somebody, especially since he or she is probably doing the same thing about you. So this unfinished business of loss really was meant to be handled by a period between childhood and adult relating, where you worked on yourself and you grieved what was missing in your past.
Could you repeat that again?
That in between childhood and adulthood, we were meant to have a period in which we would grieve what was missing, lost, or deficient from the past. And then we would go into a relationship without that set of expectations that somebody will give us all that we missed. We'll just be coming in more as adults who know that one of the givens of life is not everybody fulfills all your needs, but here's somebody who can moderately fulfill them, and that's good enough for me. Let me use this poem by Emily Dickinson because I think it expresses it in a much more powerful way. A loss of something ever felt I, the first that I could recollect. Bereft I was of what I knew not, too young that any should suspect. A mourner walked among the children. I, notwithstanding, went abroad as one bemoaning a dominion, herself the only prince cast out. Elder today, a session wiser, and fainter too as wiseness is, I find myself still softly searching for my delinquent palaces, and a suspicion like a finger touches my forehead now and then, that I am looking oppositely for the sight of the kingdom of heaven. Kingdom of heaven is within you. So she's saying, okay, I missed out on something in childhood. Nobody realized it. They didn't realize I was already grieving what was missing. I went out into the world and I thought, well, maybe somebody else will give me what I missed. And then I realize, wait a minute, you've got to look within, do your work, and only then, when you're free of the griefs that you've been carrying, are you ready to relate to someone in an adult way. Otherwise, you're looking for a parent substitute who will give you what you missed out on, which is perfectly normal, and it's understandable that we would do that. If you could look at it this way, here's childhood, and here's an adult relationship. So you emerge from childhood, and then you meet somebody when you're in your early 20s. And you think to yourself, oh, this person has all that I need and can fulfill me. And what a wonderful possibility to have a relationship with this person. And so it seems as if you can jump over from childhood to adult relating and skip the work in between. And this work is what I describe in here. It's to address what happened, the abuse, the neglect, the misattunements, the lack of attention, the lack of acceptance, the lack of appreciation, to process it by going through the feelings now that you didn't quite have the courage or wherewithal to go through in childhood, and to resolve it so you can move on. And this is called the work, of course. This is our psychological work. What is this work? To address the issue, process it, and resolve it. So now, free of the past, we can see somebody just as he or she is, rather than putting our father or mother's face on that person. Follow what I mean?
Yep.
So that's what Buber called an I-thou relationship. I see you just as you are, rather than I see you as the one who will make up for what I missed before. So that's the basic concept. I had a paragraph in here that helps. Anyone who becomes deeply important to us, so that would be somebody in a relationship, or this could even happen with your children, your brothers or sisters, your somebody at work. It can be with anybody. It doesn't have to be an intimate relationship. Anyone who becomes deeply important to us, which should itself be a suspicion, why is this person becoming so important? So I think about him night and day. I'm getting obsessed. Why is it that what he says and does matters so much? This is a pointer to something in me that needs to be looked at. Anybody who becomes deeply important to us is, by that very fact, replaying a crucial role from our past. In fact, this is how people become important. They come from central casting, and they pass the audition for us, their casting directors. We then make them the stars of our dramas. We don't call them stars. Instead, we call them soulmates, the person I was with together in another life, or archenemy. That's saying we were together in a former life is not so far off. We were together indeed, except it may not have been centuries ago, only decades or years ago. Synchronicity, meaningful coincidence, makes just the right actors come along for the audition. Our partners are then put under contract as performers who gradually memorize the scripts of our lifelong needs or fears as we're busily doing the same for them. Do I live in my own home or on a movie set? Follow what I mean? We might say we are working out our karma together. Yes, our bond and intimate relationships is often fashioned from the ancient and twisted consequences of our childhood or former relationships. How ironic that those who matter to us have become stand-ins for those who seem no longer to matter. Seems like your parents don't matter anymore. Seems like that. But why would you be looking for a stand-in then? In reality, once someone is truly no longer important, his face becomes flat-lined on the emotional screen. So this, you wouldn't need somebody to replace him because he's already faded into the past. Everybody follow so far? So this phenomenon Freud called transference, which in Latin means to carry across. You carry across the years the important characters, and then you look for others who will play their parts. Why? For a positive reason. So you can recreate the scene and this time do it differently. And this time I can get through it and get over it. If you're thinking, well, this time I can get my needs fulfilled without doing the work, I can jump from childhood to adulthood thanks to this person. I don't have to do the work in between because this relationship is so perfect. But it's not quite like that. Let's use this example. A woman falls in love with her physician. He is kind, understanding, reliable, and genuinely concerned about her every need. These are all the qualities she wished her father would have had. The patient might later marry this doctor and find out, as time goes by, that he is not quite what she imagined. Her conscious mind and heart believed she had found a replacement for her father. someone who will give me what my father couldn't give me, or what my former husband couldn't give me. But at a deeper level within her, that is in her unconscious, she was finding a substitute for father, not a replacement. The doctor husband turned out later in the relationship to be just like dad after all. Unavailable, unable to listen, though he's still listening to the patients, but not to her. The bond began with a transferred hope, but became a transferred replay. So, this helps us. Your conscious mind looks at someone and sees the possibility of satisfaction and fulfillment. But at the same time, your unconscious mind, which is the big part of the iceberg, sees the chance to complete the old business. What old business? Whatever is unfulfilled from the past. Conscious mind hears satisfaction. Unconscious, here's the chance to complete the business that's been hanging on, that's been left over. Why do we need to complete this business? Because as long as it's still hanging on, we'll be doing what Emily Dickinson is doing, still softly searching for delinquent palaces that no longer exist, that were bankrupt to begin with, rather than looking for the kingdom within.
I have a question.
You
mentioned that people resolving things within themselves in order to have an adult successful relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So do people resolve things by giving to themselves instead of looking for other people to give? Mm-hmm. Meet their needs? Do they have to find ways to meet their own needs with their own selves and give to themselves instead of looking for other people to do?
No, because as humans, we're our happiness in life and our fulfillment comes from relating to others. So it's a combination of what you find in yourself and what you find in your family, your friends, your support system, your career, and your intimate partner. But it's not supposed to be 100% from the intimate partner. It's supposed to be like, maybe 25% at most. And all the rest is supposed to come from all these other relationships.
So how do people resolve things?
You would resolve things by finally seeing what you're up to. So that's the addressing of it. And then going into the feelings. What are these feelings? Well, they're the feelings of grief, sadness, anger, and fear. I'm sad that something was missing. I'm angry at the ones who didn't provide it. And I'm afraid that no one else ever can. To sit in that kind of grief is an enormously healing position from which you finally resolve the sad losses that you came into the adult world still carrying like a albatross around your neck.
Can I ask?
Excuse me one sec. If you're blaming your parents for how inadequate they were, that would be the signal that you're not doing the work. Because now you've got it pointed to them instead of to yourself. They owe us nothing now, and we owe them nothing now. We try to have a nice relationship with them. But what is left over is our business now. It's for us to take care of it. Instead of blaming them, we understand how it was. We go through the feelings. We can still be angry at them, but we don't show them the anger now in adult life. Because what we're angry about is something left over from the past. It isn't really true in the moment. Because we're no longer in that child to adult relationship. This is an important thing to realize as part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, two questions. But the first one is, so resolution is that you've gone through that stage of that process of those feelings, and that there's no longer an emotional charge when you go through it? Is that the sign of resolution?
Yes, once it goes flatline, it no longer creates a big jump on the screen.
Then it's resolved.
That's the sign that it's resolved.
Okay.
Yeah.
The patient, has sat in this lecture, and so she's now involved with the doctor. They're married.
Yeah.
And she got, okay, I got the conscious attraction and the unconscious attraction. Now what? She got it. She
yes.
She got what you're talking about.
She understands.
She understands that. So what does she do after she realizes, oh, okay, my unconscious put me here for it, and now what?
To work on my stuff. And so let me get to work.
And she can do that.
Instead of blaming him. Mm-hmm. Or being jealous of the other female client patients. The jealousy, the blame, anything to do with him is like anything to do with the parents. It's all a distraction from what we have to work out.
And so she could go through the same experience. I'm sad, I'm angry, I'm afraid.
She has a healthy unconscious. Because her unconscious brought her to the exact guy that would show her where her work is. Once we get that, once we see that a big feature of relationship is finding somebody who shows you what you have to work on in yourself, then all relationships are successful. Because they certainly do that. If you think, well, he was supposed to satisfy me and fulfill me, conscious presumption, then it'll feel like a relationship was a big disappointment and a failure if that didn't happen. But on the unconscious level, it wasn't a failure at all. You're exactly where you need to be. He has rubbed my nose in it.
So then she does her work on herself and she heals herself. That finds herself in a relationship with someone who's unavailable, who doesn't have time for her, and so now she's healed, but she can't be in that relationship with this guy unless he maybe changes.
It would be really helpful for them to work together. Yeah. 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 It might go that way. Yes.
You mentioned initially about this period in between childhood and adulthood where you're supposed to work this and stuff, but we don't. Were you referring to perhaps indigenous cultures, rites of passage or something like that?
Yes, where things like this are worked out. Mm-hmm. Yes, but maybe if all the time we had put into algebra and geometry was on how to become a healthy adult, imagine how beneficial that would have been.
To teach that.
Yeah, right. But I want to read you my little paragraph that's kind of fun. Learning to read, I stammered out, "See Dick, see Jane." We all remember that. Did I ever imagine in first grade that it would take me another 50 years before I would be able to do just that? It's been hard work for me really to see the rosy faces of the Dicks and Janes I meet up with in life. It's required a steadfast allegiance to an unedited reality of who others are. Instead of falling into my habitual compulsion to project my own needs and beliefs onto them, it has taken conscious awareness of this person's presence here and now, whoever this person is that I'm meeting up with, free of my continual unconscious transferences from other persons, especially the ones long since vanished into the past. I found help for this in the psychological work and the spiritual practices I describe in this book. Now my vision of Dick and Jane has improved somewhat, or at least enough to notice when their faces are becoming blurred. Blurred by all the other faces over the years that left things so unfinished. So it's actually only in a rare moment that you have a true I-thou experience, where I see you just as you are, and I'm recommending mindfulness and loving kindness as the practices that help us do this, where you could see someone just as he or she is without any connection to needs from the past. It'll be a rare moment. That's what the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber called the I-thou relationship.
What percent of the population does that?
It'd be a very small percentage. Very small.
Well, because when you resolve one thing, then there's something else.
Yes. But yeah, it's this big iceberg with lots of stuff in it. Like, I had an interesting example of this that I can share. I knew my mother was abusive in many ways. And so I remembered the obvious ones, like she used to hit us and, you know, made life difficult for the three of us, myself, my brother, and my sister. So anyway, my niece was getting married in Hawaii. So I went there and, you know, we had rented a big set of condos, and my sister and I were in the same one. And of course, when you look at her from the side, she looks just like mother. And anyway, she started criticizing me from the minute we got there. She doesn't like the type of food that I eat, the California style of a diet. She doesn't like this, she doesn't like that. And I just was kind of just listening and kind of not arguing, just trying to keep the peace. And then I suddenly got angry and I burst out saying something like, "Shut the hell up." I wasn't following my practices at all. But in that moment, I had an important realization. I said, "Oh, this is what mother used to do to me. She used to criticize me. And I never remembered that until my sister did it." I tell you true, I never realized or remembered that my mother constantly criticized me. "You're too skinny. You're not like the other boys. Why can't you play baseball like everybody else? You read books too much. You're this, that." I forgot all that until my sister did it. Then I got angry and I caught myself. I said, "This level of anger isn't really about her. This goes back. This is the anger I would have shown to mother if I had had the guts to speak up." What a wonderful example, I thought to myself. And if I kept it on my sister, if I kept blaming her, I'd miss the whole point. I said to her, "Lois, I know why I reacted this way. Because you remind me of mother, you look like her, and you talk like her. This is about her. It's a minor about you." Because
you trained her.
Yeah, I'm responding to her, not to you.
Interesting. Was your sister replaying an old tape? from this.
Yes, absolutely. We're all doing this.
The dynamic she saw.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
The family.
We're all doing this Hollywood thing.
Yeah. Should be getting paid a little.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Right. Yeah, they're getting paid. Right. Exactly. Yes. Sorry.
People do this. You talk about doing the work that's necessary. You can't jump. Can people do this work on their own without like counseling? And if so, how do they do the work on their own successfully?
Well, you can do some of it, but it helps to go to therapy and try to work it out with somebody who's skilled in how to help you bring it to the surface and how to work it through. Because it's a progression. Like, first you have to see it. It took me all those years to see that one little fact. I still would not have known that my mother criticized me if I hadn't gone to Hawaii. So, because my wife never criticized me. So it just never came through because I never had that experience.
She fulfilled one of your expectations,
yeah.
Then.
Anyway, you move from being able to see it to working on it by going through the feelings and then resolving it and getting on with your life. No longer with that burden. And so, then you find out some other little facts. We never know what was actually missing. Remember what the poem says? A loss of something ever felt I. The first that I could recollect, bereft I was of what I knew not. You don't know what was missing. You just have the instinctive feeling that something's supposed to be coming to me around here and it isn't happening. And you don't know what it is. You can't put it into words. You don't have the words. Later in life, people come along who trigger, cattle prod, that exact little place in you that awakens you. If you go to blame, like if I were to blame my sister, you will never get there. You have to go direct. You have to bounce off the other and take it right back. Say, wait a minute, what's this about that comes from my story? How am I repeating my story and gathering the people around me who will play the parts so that I can see it all once again, but this time without simply repeating it, but rather working it through? I saw this program once. Was an interview. Well, it was an honoring of William Wellman. He's a Hollywood director of the past. And he directed a film called Ben-Hur. So they interviewed Charlton Heston, who's the main character. And they said, what was it like to work with William Wellman? And Charlton Heston said, well, he's very good to work with and so forth. He said, but I'll share something that happens. After about the first few weeks of whatever you call it, casting, or no, after
shooting.
Shooting, yeah. After the first few weeks of shooting, he called me over privately and he said, you're not good in this part. You're not doing this right. So Charlton Heston said, well, what do you mean? You're not doing this right. So he says, well, can you give me some hints, some advice? No. All I know is, you're not Ben-Hur. So you've got to work on this. He said, well, how am I going to work? You got to tell me. No, this is all I can tell you. So he said, I just kept coming in there day after day, listening to his direction, and gradually I got the picture, was I figured out how to do this. And later on he said, "Now you got it right. You're doing fine." And he said, "I never knew what I was missing out on, but somehow it worked." That's the kind of a director he was. Anyway, I thought to myself later, this is like a metaphor, because we hear from the director, that's the unconscious, that there's something not quite right, but he can't tell us what it is. Your unconscious mind can't tell you how to fix yourself. It can only notice it and point to it. That's all it can do, just what their old director did. And then it's up to you to do whatever it takes to get on track. This is a really good piece of information to have about your unconscious. Because when you have dreams, the dreams point to where the work is, but they can't tell you how to do it. Because the unconscious isn't set up that way. It only has the bare bones information. And then it's, you know.
How do you figure out how to do it?
Same way he did. You just keep coming to work every day. But I want to point out one more thing about this, which is so important, that we thrive in our development on two things. And it's the same two things that we see in birds. The little bird in the nest is comforted by the warm breast of mother and is fed daily by mother and father. And such a safe and secure experience within the nest makes for a wonderful feeling of security. But at a certain point, mother will push baby out of the nest, and she'll be in midair, and she will have to flap her own wings, and she will have to fly. That's the second half, which is called challenge. So it's comfort and then challenge. And our psychological development happens in exactly the same way. We come from the comfort of being held securely, and then we face the challenge of getting on with our life on our own. Perfect example. You're at home, taken care of by your parents, and then at a certain time, they make you go to school. And that's the challenge of being out in the big world. And it seems scary because your parents aren't there, but you have to do it. And the comfort moves into challenge. And then when you're there in the school for a while, it starts to feel comforting, and then they challenge you with new things to learn, and you go all through life with these two things. So in a relationship, it's the same way. You're looking for comfort from somebody, but you want to be with somebody who challenges you so you can expand, so you can be more than what you came in as. And that challenge happens through the transference, which is why Freud, who discovered the transference in 1895, made it the central point of the therapy. He said you can do the entire healing process through the transference. And the way he did it was to be the new father figure who listens to you and helps you grow. And that opens up the subject of what your own actual father was like.
Well, that presupposes that this principal wound is the father. What if it's the mother?
It's whoever the nurturant parent was, mostly, and wherever there was something missing. And by the way, even if you had Donna Reed as your mother, you would still have something to work on. Because as humans, we carry the griefs of the ages in our archetypal psyche. So no matter how good it was, there would always be something that you need to work on. Yes?
You have your own self to deal with.
Yes, absolutely.
When you're done with everybody else.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I mentioned in the book is the four conflict areas where this kind of stuff will come up. There will always be conflict around these four things: comings and goings. New people coming into your life and people going from your life. Letting somebody new in to relate to and ending a relationship. Comings and goings. That will always be full of conflict, anxiety, giving and receiving. Have I been given enough? Have I received enough? Am I giving enough? Are they receiving? You can see why Christmas is so conflicted. Because it includes the giving and the receiving, and the comings and goings, because the relatives are coming to visit. Third, being accepted and being rejected. All through life, that's going to be an issue. And finally, the letting go and going on. I talk about each one of those and how to work with them, but how to scale these hurdles with grace. It's powerful that things like this make such a big difference. I want to give an interesting example. Regarding the comings and goings, if I can find it. Well, I can just tell you if I can't find it. It's has to do with someone is picking you up at the airport and he doesn't show up. And you just stand there and you're waiting. But the longer you wait, the more do you feel like, oh, I just don't matter. So they didn't even bother coming to pick me up. And so you're moving from what's probably an honest mistake, like you got the time wrong, from an honest mistake right into the tensions and the anxieties that have to do with whether somebody really cares about enough about you to come and pick you up. That would be an example of how you clue into something that still needs to be worked on. It's hard for me to believe that you're standing there in the airport, and it's hard for me to believe that somebody would really be there for me when needed. Imagine all the stuff that comes up around that kind of question. So I'm thinking that we're getting opportunities all the time to find out where our work is. The biggest one is any reaction that you have to what someone else does. Second biggest one, any attraction or repulsion. Those will all be clues to a connection that's bigger than the people you're looking at. The bigger the reaction, the more history is it including? If you could look at it that way.
Does it include politics?
Yes. Absolutely. I also show how it connects with religion, because sometimes our image of God is really about our image about our Father. Yeah.
You know, when I share these ideas with my experience has been sometimes when I'm talking about this with someone who doesn't necessarily think this way, the response is, what about sometimes the situations when the base value, it's not the reaction, whatever reaction we have or repulsion we have because of what the person did. It's a face value thing. Maybe your dad did it too, but in the here and now, what they just did was inappropriate.
Sometimes it's just real in itself and it's not really transference. Yes.
So
I talk about that in here.
You do?
Yeah, and show the difference.
Can you say it in an accent?
Yeah. First of all, you would only transfer onto somebody who really does have these similar characteristics. We're not crazy. So, you know, we're finding people who do resemble the characters of our past. That's the first thing. The way to tell the difference is very simple. If it keeps gnawing at you and you can't let go of it, you know that's your clue. It's hooking up, it's piggybacking something from the past. If you deal with it directly and just let go of it and move on, then you know it's just about here and now. I use an example in the book of... you know how in the bank there's a sign that says, please fill out your deposit slip before approaching the counter? Okay. So let's say you go up to the counter and you have not filled it out. One possible response is that the teller will look sternly at you and say, didn't you see the sign? You're supposed to fill this out before you come up here. Okay, that's number one. Second person, the next teller, says, a lot of people forget to fill out the deposit slip. I'll fill it out for you. Now, compare the two reactions. And the first one might remind you of a parent who was stern towards you and who somehow made you feel bad that you didn't follow the rules as you were supposed to. Whereas the second person gave you a sense of comfort and welcome, and later on, when you leave the bank, you might remember each of them. The first one with some anger, and the second one with a kindly feeling. Well, this is responding to you. So this is perfectly normal, because one has been judgmental and the other's been kind. And so if you drop it by the time you get to close the door of the bank, then it's just what it is. But if it hangs on, then it gives you other information. Other questions about this? Do you find this an interesting topic?
Absolutely.
I think it's fascinating. I just can't believe how much there is to it. This took me 3 years to write. And before that, 3 years to do research. But most of my research is from my own actual experience.
So if the past is present a lot, does that mean you still have a lot of unfinished work on yourself to do?
Yes.
That's the obvious conclusion.
Yeah, which we all do. If we can see the transference as helping us, because it points to where we need to go. It's like a clue on a treasure hunt. What is the treasure? The completion of our business. Will we ever complete it fully? No, of course not. But we can certainly do a little more than we have done.
Can you say something more about doing the work? I think you mentioned acknowledging what the issue is and then feeling the feelings. Can you say, you know, if there's something more that helps shift things, helps you do the work, another step, another phase? Or is just feeling
yes.
the feelings enough from your perspective?
It's feeling the feelings and hooking it up to the past.
And identifying.
Oh, yes, this is what happened before, and here I am again. Except this time, I'm not that little kid with no power. Now I have the power to look at my stuff and it can make a difference. I think you might find it interesting because I applied this to pets. They are...
They bring up
a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Ever watched a dog whisperer?
Yes.
You know.
That idea. Pets are certainly apt objects of transference. A dog will comfort us, provide a sense of connection, love us unconditionally, keep us company, cheer us up, remain loyal, and certainly be more of an expert at giving the 5 A's than many humans. Any creature that can give all that has to be an apt candidate for transference. That's why we become so attached. We begin to see our pets as persons, sometimes as our children or partners. We become attached and are deeply concerned about their safety and health. They become important to our happiness. Human needs are being fulfilled by an animal. There's nothing wrong in any of this, but it is useful to notice the transference dimension. How much of our sense of isolation is made up for by Spot's faithful presence when Dick or Jane has left us. We can trust to see Spot run with us instead of away from us, as Dick and Jane sometimes do. Perhaps this loyalty from Spot can make us feel securely accompanied in life. Accompanied life. The Lord is my shepherd. It's a religious experience. Transference can then be a reminder of how much we missed in our past. It is also a reminder of how much we have to be thankful for in pets who so reliably and willingly make up for our woeful losses.
If you own a cat, though, you know your true position in life.
Yes. Yes, they're great Zen teachers. Yes?
Would you go over the 5 A's? You went very quickly over them, but
oh, okay.
You mentioned them again.
It's that we had a need to be paid attention to, accepted as we are. Appreciated, which means valued, from which we get our self-esteem. Shown affection in physical ways, non-sexually in childhood, sexually in adulthood, if that's our choice. And finally, allowing us to choose the path in life that is best for us rather than the one that they thought was best for us.
Thank you.
And we instinctively knew that we needed all that. So if one of those was missing, it would leave a hole inside. That's what they mean by the emotional wounds. It leaves a hole inside, and we're looking, who can fill this? Instead of, how do I look through this into what I'm really about and bring healing to it with the help of others as I do my work, rather than expecting others to fill it for me so I never have to look into it. That's where we make our big mistake. Because we think that someone else can actually do that. They can't really. No. They, I mean, in, on the, during the honeymoon they can. But then you're the little bird in the nest. The warmth, the comfort, and it seems like, oh, everything is now fulfilled, and forget the past. But soon the past starts to show itself again. Why does it show itself again? Because the urge toward health is bigger than the urge toward gratification. The way we're constructed, we have a bigger and stronger inclination to work it all out rather than to find something that makes it go away.
Well, why are there probably more people addicted to things than people working it out?
Well, it's just the nature of our society that
it's painful,
recommends the gratification.
See, that was some of the opposite of what you just said. I mean, if it's more, if it, we're more inclined to work it out than to soothe it over, why is so many people soothing it over and not working it out?
Because they don't know.
Well, you mean successfully soothing it over without working it out? Or do you mean just temporarily soothing?
Well, I mean, I don't know what people are doing. I only know what I see around me, right? But it seems like there's a lot written about people, you know, finding their self-medication, and that's a big problem.
Yes.
There's lots of things, institutions in society that would fall apart if people didn't have those problems.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big thing happening in our country.
Yes. And one of the signs of health is when you learn the art of self-soothing.
In a healthy way.
Alcohol and drugs would be soothing, but they're not really good for us.
Well, I was wondering, you had talked about the safe nest, the safety people have, and then they get kicked out of the nest into the challenging world.
Yeah.
But I'm, you know, more and more aware of people who might not have ever had the safe nest, where there was a lot of drugs and alcohol, violence, whatever, in that nest. So I'm wondering if that might have something to do with what we're talking about.
Yes, very much so.
And how that changes a person's tendency if you've never had that in the beginning.
Yeah, I have something in here about, you know, when you have an alcoholic background in your childhood, and you're always on pins and needles as to what's going to happen. I use the example of the kid who comes home from school and he doesn't know if he's going to find his mother drunk on the floor or ready with the cocoa and cookies. And if she is on the floor, he's going to have to become the parent. And what kind of a relationship you would look for later in life, that, you know, to try to work that out. And by the way, Alcoholics Anonymous offers a wonderful example of how to work through the transference. Because transference gets worked through in three stages. First, you find that others understand you. Then you look up to them and want to imitate them. And then you become one of them. So when you first go to the AA program, they understand you, a drinker who's trying to stop. Then you start looking up to them, people who have found a way to be sober, and imitate them. And third, you become one of them, and then you're helping others who come after you. So I see it as a wonderful example of how the transferences work through within a group setting. Well, our time is about up, so let's have one more question, and then I'd like to end with a poem.
I'd like
yes,
to ask one.
Please.
What about parent-children relationships where there's too much nurturing, where the parent attempts to first protect the child from any outside agitations and tries to keep them dependent?
Mm-hmm. Then you would be missing
the person looking for.
Then you'd be missing the challenge part, and you'd come into the adult relating with a sense of entitlement that somebody's going to take care of me, somebody's going to parent me. When becoming an adult is learning to parent yourself. Yes, you think it was their duty. That's the entitlement.
Do you address that in your book?
Yes, yes, because that's the alternative instead of. See, needs are either not fulfilled enough or excessively fulfilled.
Yeah. Excessive fulfillment.
Indulged in such a way that you didn't get the challenge half. By the way, a religion would not be a suitable. A religion becomes suitable for an adult when it offers both comfort and challenge. It offers the comfort of the Lord is my shepherd and the beautiful images and so forth, but then it offers the challenge, Sermon on the Mount, Ten Commandments, nonviolence. That's what's going to feel right. It will always feel right. Something will always feel right when it offers both comfort and challenge. It will never feel right when there's no comfort, just challenge. Or no challenge, just comfort. Because we're just built that way. Before I end with a poem, and if you have other questions, I'll stay after, so just come up and ask me. I have the flyers over there in case you're interested, because I'm doing a whole day on this topic in Monterey. Kind of far, but if you happen to be interested, it's there. And I'd like to end with this beautiful poem by Tennessee Williams from The Night of the Iguana, because we haven't talked about nature, and in this poem he shows how nature can become a form of self-soothing and a teacher for us. How calmly does the orange branch observe the sky begin to blanch? Without a cry, without a prayer, with no betrayal of despair. Sometime while night is in the tree, the zenith of its life will be gone past forever, and from thence a second history shall commence, a chronicle no longer gold, a bargaining with mist and mold, the broken stem, the plummeting to earth, and then an intercourse not well designed for beings of a golden kind, whose native green must arch above the earth's obscene corrupting love. Still the ripe fruit and the branch observe the sky begin to blanch, without a cry, without a prayer, with no betrayal of despair. Oh, courage, could you not as well select a second place to dwell? Not only in that golden tree, but in the frightened heart of me. Thank you all.
Do you have the Emily Dickinson poem in your book?
Yes.